Okay, so Om Ganatsu Madhavasha, Ananjana, Shalakaya Chakshur, Miritam, Yena Tosmai, Shigurvena Maha. So we're reading from Srila Prabhupada's translation commentary of the Bhagavad Gita as it is. And before we start reading, I'd like to, maybe we'll get, the whole lecture will be on this topic before we even read, to unpack the title of this particular chapter. It's called The Most Confidential Knowledge. Now, in English, that's called superlative. Like you have, you know, comparative and even higher. So you have like more confidential knowledge. You have confidential knowledge, more confidential knowledge was a comparative. And then you have the superlative, the most confidential knowledge. So because we have so few people here, I'd like to make this more interactive. So who knows what just plain old confidential knowledge is? According to the Bhagavad Gita. What's confidential knowledge? You're not the body. That's the first thing that Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita. You know, dehino smen yata dehe, komaram jovaram jara, tata dehantaras praptir diras tatra namuyati. Now you may say, that's not so confidential. Well, you can go out and talk to just about anybody in America and ask them, who are you? And they're going to say, I am Joe Blow or Susan whatever. I am American or I'm white or I'm black or I'm a plumber or I'm an electrician or I work on the internet. You know, this is all bodily identifications. And people, and even in the religions, they haven't understood that point. And the, most people practice different religions. I was just doing some research in one particular religion. I'm taking a course. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss it because I don't want to criticize any particular religion. But where they actually believe that the body somehow or other becomes eternal at a certain juncture if you have faith in a certain type of process, that somehow or other, you know, the bones come out and they rise. At, they don't describe what age the bones rise at. I hope, for my sake, it's like at 16 or 18. You know, I wouldn't want to rise at my age. So they're going to have to rejuvenate my bones, you know, do some stem cell transplants and things like that. So that I can have some nice young bones. Anyway, so it is pretty confidential. I mean, how many people in America? Of course, in India, India is such a wonderful place because basically everybody, not everybody, but most people believe in reincarnation. It's just like, huh? It's a no-brainer. That's why India is the land of religion. I mean, there's a lot of things in India that are not so fantastic. You know, there's things there. It's not perfect because of the influence of different invaders over so many years. I mean, the original Indian culture, going back thousands and thousands of years old ago, is a spiritual culture. And it's a moral culture. And for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, you don't have Krishna talking to Arjuna so much about morality because Arjuna already knew the principles like, you know, you honor your father and mother. Huh? Duh. Isn't it? In America, we got to talk about that. Honor your father and mother, you know, just don't give them some euthanasia when they get a little old. You know, that, you know, put people to sleep. I mean, even, you know, in the Western world, they think mercy killing, not only of human beings, but animals. We had this problem in the UK. And UK means United Kingdom, Great Britain, where we had a cow that was getting older, and the cow, you know, wasn't able to stand, and so the devotees being let it have a natural death, so the government came in and thought this is cruel and unusual punishment, therefore we have to kill the cow. You know, so there's this whole concept of getting rid of something when it creates difficulty or pain for you, and there's no concept of duty, morality, and the word duty in America is, you know, a no-no. If people hear the word duty, you know, you have to do, this is your dharma or your duty, to take care of your parents, they say, huh? You know, it's my duty to take care of myself. It's a very self-centered culture. So anyway, in India, basically, practically anyone you ask, you know, was at least the Hindus, they accept reincarnation. You know, you don't have to preach to them about that reincarnation. Of course, there's a lot of things, a lot of confusion too. You know, a lot of confusion as to who is God, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually, even the sages one time, this is an interesting story. I'll probably give the class just the title of the chapter. But the sages, for example, had a whole discussion. Even these great sages in India, they're having this discussion. Who's God? Is it Brahma? Is it Vishnu? Or is it Shiva? Alright, so the sages were talking back and forth, you know, throwing their philosophical points back and forth at each other. And then they turned to one of the sages, who was a great personality. His name was Bhrigu Muni. And they said to him, hey, you should figure out for us who is the Supreme. You know, because they were all just immersed in Hinduism. So, they didn't know. So Bhrigu Muni said, alright, let me devise a test so I can figure out who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Okay. So Bhrigu Muni happens to be Brahma's son. And he also happens to be the brother of Lord Shiva. So it's a good family. They picked the right person, obviously. So first he goes to Lord Brahma to give Lord Brahma the God test. And he goes to Lord Brahma and he says, my dear... He doesn't say anything. Lord Brahma says, oh, my dear son. And Bhrigu Muni basically ignores him, doesn't pay obeisances, because in a high-class culture, when you see your parents, you're supposed to, you know... Maybe not Dandabats, but at least Mamashri. Oh, Mamashri's uncle. But Matashri. Forgetting my Hindi. So Mamashri's uncle on the mother's side. So anyway, so I go, my dear mother, like that. Nowadays, of course, in America, they just call the mother by her name. Hey, Josephine. Where's my inheritance? Did you leave me in the will? Anyway, so he goes up to Lord Brahma, and basically, you know, he says, how you doing, pal, you know, or something. Like that doesn't treat him with respect. Lord Brahma starts to get angry, a little smoke comes from his ears. But he's able to control his anger because he's Lord Brahma. You know, he's also influenced by passion. That's true. Influenced by passion. You know, that's Lord Brahma's in charge. He's the Guna avatar. He's in charge of the mode of passion. So, you know, when you're in charge of passionate things, sometimes you get a little passion, even though he's a great devotee. We see this sometimes, that if you're in charge of building a new project or something, like we have this new project across the street, you know, the temple, sometimes devotees get a little passionate about it. So Lord Brahma got a little passionate, and he got, who's this kid, you know? I brought him up from when he popped out of my mind. You know, he's a mind-born son. No mother. Actually, it's a fact. Lord Brahma, he can have children without his wife. Pretty good, isn't it? Don't you try that. So what he did is he got angry, but he was able to control his anger, and he didn't do anything to Bhrigu Muni. But Bhrigu Muni saw, you know, you see when someone gets angry, you know, the teeth come out and their eyes close up like that. And so he thought, this guy's not God. So he left, and he thought, you know, next visit, Lord Shiva, let's test him. So Lord Shiva, he tested in a way that was pretty radical, very radical. He went to Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva said, oh, my dear brother, Bratashri, my dear brother. And he said to Lord Shiva, don't touch me, you impure. You're hanging around, you have these skulls around your neck, and you go to crematoriums, all your disciples are ghosts and goblins. He's called Bhutanath. Bhutanath means he's the lord of the Bhutas, you know, like the ghosts. So he went, so he said that to Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva just wanted to give him a big warm and fuzzy hug, you know, or something like that. And then Lord Shiva gets really angry. He says, this is it, you know. He may be my brother, but he's finished. Because Lord Shiva definitely is the controller of the mode of ignorance. And, you know, anger is a manifestation of ignorance. So he was ready to blast Brigamuni, kill him, whatever. And fortunately, Parvati came and said, dear, he's your brother. You should tolerate your brother and not kill him. And so, so Brigamuni, he could see Lord Shiva's anger. I mean, that was obvious. I mean, there were frankly flames coming out of Lord Shiva's eyes at that particular juncture. So then, he thought, he's not God, because he's not in the mode of goodness. God must be in the mode of goodness. Okay, one more person to test. He went to Lord Vishnu, and immediately when he saw Lord Vishnu, he kicked Lord Vishnu in the chest. Boom! And, you know, with Lord Brahma, was just simply ignoring him. With Lord Shiva, was harsh words, verbal abuse. But with Vishnu, was physical abuse. And you just don't do that with the Lord. I mean, in polite culture, in Indian culture, it's understood that the feet are very impure. And even Prabhupada instructed us, because we Westerners, we didn't know that. We thought, you know, feet are pure, feet, you know. We thought the whole body is pure, what to speak of the feet. And so Prabhupada even told us, you don't go moving furniture with your feet. Did you know that? You know, so many times we move things around. You can move your shoes with your feet. That's permitted. But Prabhupada would get upset when devotees, in India people know this. I mean, in America we didn't know, you know, to wash our hands after eating. We thought, you know, just, you know, lick them clean. Yeah, well, didn't we? I mean, I thought, what do we know? You know, if you had a little boo-boo, you know, a little cut, your mother would kiss it and lick it for you. That's what my mother did. So we didn't know any of these things. But, you know, feet, because your feet are walking everywhere. And they're considered not the purest part of your body. So you're not supposed to even move furniture or touch anything. If you touch someone with your feet, if you touch a picture of Krishna with your feet, you're supposed to offer obeisance. I think Prabhupada said 100 times or something like that. Isn't that amazing? Boom. So this is culture. This is actually culture. You know, we have to learn culture. Original Indian culture is very refined. Very, very refined. So, anyway. So he kicks Lord Vishnu in the chest, and Lord Vishnu, instead of getting angry, says, please accept my apologies for having a hard chest. And Brigamuni is shocked, huh? What's happening here? You know, apology. How many of us could apologize if someone kicked us in the chest? Anybody here? Vanamali could do it. But the rest of us, I mean, I would probably break my Brahmin thread cursing the person. Or take some water like they do in these movies, you know, like I curse you to become a dog in Pataloka or something like that. But Lord Vishnu, he just said, please, accept my apologies. I'm sorry if I hurt your foot. And he began to massage Brigamuni's foot. And so Brigamuni thought, he is God. But at the same time, he did make an offense. And that offense was that he kicked the Lord in the chest. Definitely you don't want to do that. And as a result, Lakshmi was there, who is Lord Vishnu's wife. And she got angry at Brigamuni, and she said to Brigamuni, you know, actually cursed practically all the Brahmins. She said, the Brahmins are going to be poor. It's a good reason not to be a Brahmin. It's better to be a Kshatriya or a Vaishya. But in any case, that's one test that was done, you know, amongst many Hindus to determine who is God. I mean, there's many other stories. I'm going to tell one or two other stories, like stories. Once upon a time, Lord Shiva's abode was in a place called Kashi. And Kashi, you know, Varanasi, same thing. So, this king of Kashi was called, of course, Kashi Raj. It was interesting. It's interesting, this morning we had a class, The word we use, Gajapati, referring to the elephants who guard the directions, you remember? That's also a name of a king. Kings are also called Gajapati. So there's different metaphorical ways to understand that particular verse. Tristan. Anyway, I was thinking about that when I heard that word. The king of Orissa is called Gajapati. The elephant king. Anyway, it's not one of Walt Disney's movies, you know, the elephant king or the lion king. But that was a traditional name in Sanskrit for a king. So Kashi Raj, he was a great devotee of Lord Shiva, obviously, because he lived in Kashi. And he worshipped Lord Shiva and got from Lord Shiva the Trishura, you know, the trident. And that's like Lord Shiva's ultimate weapon. And he got the benediction from Lord Shiva that whoever attacked him, Lord Shiva would personally come and defend him. And he thought, now it's time to attack Dwarka. So he attacked Dwarka, and lo and behold, Krishna fought back, obviously. And Lord Shiva came to assist, and Krishna sent his Sudarshan Chakra disc after Lord Shiva. And Lord Shiva was running everywhere to escape the Sudarshan Chakra disc, finally went back to Lord Vishnu and said, apologize to him. Krishna apologized to him. And Krishna said something very interesting in this story. This story is from the Chaitanya Bhagavat part of the story. And Krishna said to Lord Shiva, he said, no one hates me more than you. And the reason he said that was not that Lord Shiva hates Vishnu, but when someone who you love attacks you, it's actually much more painful. I mean, if someone on the street just attacks you, it's painful. But if someone you love attacks you, it's extremely painful. It's like a knife in the heart. So that proves that Vishnu is superior. And also there's many verses that prove that Krishna is the source of all the Vishnu incarnations. Of course, the primary verse in the Bhagavatam that we refer to is Ete Changsa Kalakpumsa, Krishna's two Bhagavan Swayam. In the Bhagavatam, we hear the list of all the different or various incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So getting back to the point. So in India, basically everyone, or at least the Hindus, accept that you're not the body. So that's confidential knowledge. So what is more confidential knowledge? And you're supposed to serve Krishna. Like Yat Karoshi Yadash Nashi Yajahoshi Dadasi Yat. You know, Karma Yoga, which is taken later on in the Bhagavad Gita. So that's more confidential, that you're a servant of Krishna, you're supposed to serve Krishna, and you'll get all the good results if you serve Krishna. So that's more confidential knowledge. So the most confidential knowledge, anybody have any ideas? That's one thing, yeah. But most confidential about Krishna would be about Krishna personally. Because you do have an indication of Anyavirashita Shunyam earlier in the Bhagavad Gita. But no one has an idea, I'll give you a hint. The most confidential is that Krishna has his own life apart from this material world, which is really astounding. And you basically don't find that information anywhere except in the Vedic literatures, that God has his own abode, and he's also everywhere in the material world. The most confidential has something to do with what we call a Chincha Veda Veda Tattva philosophy. What does that mean? That means God is immanent and eminent. And so in other words, he's everywhere, and he's also not everywhere, he's also somewhere else too at the same time. He's everywhere, and he's also never leaves his abode simultaneously. This is called one indifferent, simultaneously inconceivable understanding. Achincha, which means inconceivable, also means without anxiety. But anyway, achincha, veda, aveda, means one and different simultaneously, tattva, which is the nature of God. Tattva is the nature. The nature of God, the nature of Krishna, is that he's one in the spiritual world, and he's everywhere simultaneously, and it's inconceivable. I mean, we can give some metaphors to try to understand this, One metaphor would be the sun. Like the sun by its rays the sun is all pervading. Like we can say, if the sun is out, it's not out right now, open the curtains, let the sun in. But nobody's actually letting the sun into the room. It would be quite warm, millions of degrees. We would have a crematorium here. But the sun, in one sense, the sun is all pervading through the sunshine. And then you have the sun globe. And interestingly enough, you also have entities on the sun, and you know, there's a person in charge of the sun. He's called, who? Does anyone know? Viva Swan. Drishan Prabhu was making reference to that this morning. There was one atheist who actually said there's a possibility there's living entities on the sun, right? Don't want to mention the atheist's name. It's too polluting for me. So there might be entities. There might be entities on the sun, but they wouldn't have bodies based on carbon compounds, like which our body, you know, we all organic matter is based on carbon. Obviously, in the sun, you'd be carbonized. You understand? Carbonized means you take some wood and you burn it, and it becomes ashes or black, and that's carbonized wood. So you would become more than carbonized if you went to the sun. But there's other elements. There's subtler elements. There's, of course, the Panchamahabhuta, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and then the subtle elements, mind, intelligence, and false ego. So there's a lot of subtle things in this world that we can't perceive, subtle elements that we can't perceive that certainly would not be scorched by the sun. What to speak of the soul? And Krishna says, you know, the soul is not withered by the wind or burned by fire. That's the most subtle thing. Or it's spiritual, not even materially subtle. So anyway, there are living entities on the sun. It's hard to imagine, but there are. And their bodies are equipped specifically to be like that. So getting on with that metaphor. There's a chief living entity. Obviously. I mean, anywhere you go, there's always someone in charge or a group of people in charge. You know, why not in the universe? In America we have, you know, you have a president, and every country you have someone in charge or a group of people in charge, so why not in universal affairs? And that's, of course, Govinda Madhi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami, that's Krishna. So Krishna is there, using that metaphor of the sun. So the sun god is there, but the sun is also all pervading through its energy. The energetic rays, the photons, and sunshine. So in the same way, through Krishna's energy, he's everywhere. And Prabhupada, at certain times, he said, when you're sitting on a seat, you can see, think you're sitting on Krishna. Not Krishna's spiritual body. And not only that, but Krishna is also manifest everywhere through his Paramatma expansion. Not only through the energy, let's say this energy, which is the material energy, which is dull matter. But within the dull matter, there is an expansion of Krishna in every atom. So it's not that the matter has become alive, but the matter has life in it. And not only within every atom, there's an expansion of Krishna, but there's also an individual soul in every atom. I mean, things get very complex. I mean, the material energy is endlessly mutable and unlimitedly complex. That's one of the things we learn from reading the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, isn't it? It's so complex that nobody understands it except for Krishna. And even Krishna's expansion, Ananta Shesh, who is glorifying Krishna, can't come to an understanding or an end of the glorification of Krishna because Krishna's unlimited. So even he can't understand. So here we are trying to use our tiny little brains to understand things. Krishna's a chincha. He's inconceivable. So Krishna's in every atom. There's a soul in every atom. The soul, of course, is in an unconscious, inert state, just waiting to get the opportunity to, you know, manifest itself There's some sort of activity like animal species or what to speak of human species or demigod species or something like that. So there's unlimited, practically speaking, unlimited souls and unlimited universes. I mean, this is so amazing. We're hearing this today about, I was so inspired by class this morning, how Drissa Prue was talking about how the scientists first thought there were how many universes? There's one universe. And so how many stars? Galaxy.
And then they looked in the outer space and saw that there are actually millions of galaxies.
And then
the galaxies fill millions of stars.
Yeah, and the more they look, the more galaxies they find. And then they find things they can't even understand, like dark matter, isn't it? Or dark energy. You know, way, that's just something, a construct they use to explain something they don't understand, basically. And, you know, why things are continually expanding at a quicker rate. They can't explain that. You know, it's dark energy, of course. So, it's just amazing. And Krishna's just sitting there. This is the teaching of the ninth chapter. Krishna's just sitting there in the spiritual world enjoying himself, playing on a flute, and these unlimited, inconceivable things are happening here in the material world. And the material world is just one quarter of Krishna's creation. It's like Krishna's garbage dump. You know, we think it's a great place, but it's where Krishna sends, you know, it's Krishna's, in, just like if you go to what, is it Butner where they have the insane asylum? Sorry. Mental hospital, sorry, not insane asylum. I gotta speak politically correct language now. People who are challenged in different ways. So, I mean, it's just like, if you go there, that's not an important part of the government's energy. But here we are. And why do I say that we're insane? And later on in the chapter, we're going to hear about why we're insane. We're insane because we think we're the center. We're attached to our false identification. It's just like if a hypnotist goes on the stage and he hypnotizes someone to thinking they're a donkey. I mean, I've seen that. People, it actually works, you know. Now you are a donkey. You are an ass. Ah! You know, whatever they do. Then, I mean, it's insane. So, Maya, Krishna's energy, which is also mentioned in this chapter. This chapter is an amazing chapter. This Maya bewilders everyone into thinking, you know, that I am whatever I think I am. You know, male, female, we went over those things before. Or I'm, you know, 65 years old. Oh my God, don't remind me. So, this hypnotizes us. And it's actually, Krishna's playing, as they say sometimes, Krishna's playing pin the tail on the donkey and we're the donkey. And we're having the tail pinned on us here in this world. So this is amazing. It's simply amazing. Krishna's illusory energy. Like Prabhupada actually said one time, it's not amazing that you can see God, it's amazing that the people can't see God. What did Prabhupada mean that? By that, that Krishna's mama maya durachya, that Krishna's material energy is so amazing, how it bewilders people. It's like the most amazing hypnotist, isn't it? Wow. I mean, it's even, you know, pure devotee looks at it and he becomes amazed when he sees this. So anyway, that's Krishna. And so this is the essence of the most confidential knowledge that's going to be described in this chapter. So now we're going to, do we have time to go on to the chapter? To read a verse or two. Okay, so this is called chapter 9, the most confidential knowledge. It's been 36 minutes already. We'll just start. So this is a basic summary of what happens in the chapter, you know, summarizing some of the verses, like in the first and third verse, you talk about the qualifications for hearing. I mean, one of the qualifications we'll read the verse is that you shouldn't be envious. And, you know, the envious person is disqualified. And I don't want to get ahead of myself, but the reason an envious person is disqualified is because in order to understand transcendental knowledge, you require the help of someone called the super soul. Gopal, that's not a superhero. you know, Gopal loves these superheroes. But it's not. He's a real superhero. Super soul is in your heart, and he's giving you remembrance, forgetfulness, and knowledge. Mata smritir jnanam aponam cha, according to your desire. So if you want to forget him, then he gives you illusory information so you can forget him. So you can become a first-class atheist and write books about it. Krishna is actually the best atheist, because where does a knowledge, intelligence come from to be an atheist? Krishna. Krishna's writing all these atheists. They should just put their name down instead of so-and-so. This atheistic book written by the Supreme Personality. And it's interesting with atheists that they spend so much time on God. If God doesn't exist, well, you know, why even talk about him? You know, why not just say, you know, it's just a foolish thing. We're not going to waste time. I mean, if I was an atheist, I wouldn't waste time talking about God, would you? I'd have better things to do, like hang gliding and, you know, and fun things. But because the proof that they think there's God, or, you know, underneath subconsciously or something like that, is that they write so much about God. And then also when they're at the time of death, what do they say? There's no atheists in the foxholes. Mm-hmm. At the time of death, they start doing this. I mean, I've seen it with some of my family members who are out and out atheists. When they get ready to die, you know, they start asking me about God. And my grandfather, for example, he died of Parkinson's disease. Never asked this spiritual question his whole life. Up until the time he was, you know, he didn't believe in God. Up until the time he was getting ready to die. And he came to me and he said, "My dear grandson, what happens at the time of death? Of course, his wife said, "Shut up. Don't ask questions like that." And for the first time in his life, he told her to shut up. I said, I admired him, you know. Anyway, she was a heavy lady. She also became a devotee. And I'll tell you about that in a second. So at the time of death, he was asking me these questions. And I said, "Don't worry, because I am your grandson. I'm doing devotional service. You're headed to a better destination." Because, you know, if someone is Krishna conscious, they save so many generations of their family. He said, "Thank you very much." And she was so upset that I talked to him about God. Yeah. I didn't ask him for a donation, don't worry. And then later on, after he died, she would be coming to all my lectures. This is in Miami. She came to my lectures to the Sunday feast. Isn't that Mother Krishnapriya? She would come to my lectures and say, "This is so nice." She would embrace me and start crying and everything like that. Finally, right before she left her body, I gave her some Radhakund water, which I snuck into her coffee without her knowing. So anyway, that was a funny story. So basically, people do know there's God, it's just they're afraid to admit it. And especially people from India, they know that Krishna is God. Everybody knows that Krishna is God, except, you know, it's just sometimes afraid to admit it, because if you admit it, then there's something you got to do about it. Right? So anyway, so getting back to the point, before I get to the deeper. So getting back to the point, Anasuyave is one of the words used in the beginning of the ninth chapter, that one should not be envious. That's a disqualification, because if you're envious, the super soul will not reveal himself to you. Idam tu te gudu yatumam prabhaksha manasuyave ganaviganam asti. I forget the rest of the poem coming. Anyway, either suyave means envious. Brahma, Vijnana, Yagyadwa, Moksha, Se, Shubhat. Yeah, understanding this, you'll become liberated, right? So, because if you're envious, super soul will think, "I'm not going to show myself to him." Like if someone's envious of me and they ask me, "Can you please tell me something confidential about your life?" I say, "Get out of my face." Isn't it? So Krishna says the same thing if someone is envious. And what does it mean to be envious? I mean, that's an interesting question too. You've got to unpack that term. All these terms need to be unpacked. Envious means you want something that someone else has, or you want to be what someone else is. right? So basically, we want something that Krishna has. Just like our friend Ravana, what did he want? Sita. So we all want Sita, Lakshmi, right? Lakshmi. And of course you don't get Lakshmi if you want her without Krishna. You get Maya Lakshmi, you get Durga, and you get in trouble. So, and also we want to be God. And Ishwara Hamaham Bogi Siddham Balavan Sukhi. We want to be the center. We think we're perfect, we're powerful, we're happy. You know, the man's helm is his castle, right? Yeah. So in this way, we're actually thinking we want to be God in a very real sense. Not in the sense we put our name up, I'm God. Some people do that. Some people actually do that. They come up with a philosophy, you know, I'm God. And it doesn't go over very well with God. There was one, this is an interesting story, one story in the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. There was one gentleman, his name was Pondrika, and he said, I'm Vasudev, I'm God. And he had some mystic powers. He wasn't just like your ordinary puny little demon. He was a superhero. Gopal. He had mystic powers, yeah. What? A super demon. So he had mystic powers, and he challenged Krishna. He actually was so bewildered by all of his mystic powers, he actually thought he was God. Not only did he tell people he was God, he thought he was God. That's even worse. I mean, it's all right to tell people you're God, but don't think it yourself. So, but he thought he was God, so he went and challenged Krishna and said, let's have a duel, you know, your Sudarshan Chakra against mine. And Krishna said, all right, here, catch. You know, like a frisbee game. Krishna threw his Sudarshan Chakra, and then immediately he caught it on his neck. And then his head was chopped off. So people in this world generally, usually it's not so blatant like that. But generally, we want to be the center, the enjoyer, enjoyer and the proprietor. These are the divisions of false ego. So when we have that consciousness, Krishna doesn't reveal himself to us. Anasuyave, we have to become non-envious. And so what does non-envious mean? That's a negative definition. The actual definition of non-envy is in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. 529. Bhaktaram jagatapasam sarva loka maheshram suvidam sarva buddhanam gatva mam shanti richati. That is really what it means to be non-envious, because you can't just go by a negative definition. I'm not envious, but what are you? You know, we tend to define things by negative definitions sometimes, but a positive definition is actually the real thing. So the real thing to be non-envious means to understand that Krishna is the enjoyer, Bhoktaram Jagata, of all activities, sacrifices, Sarva Loka Maheshwara. He's the Lord. He's in charge. He's Ishwara. Maheshwara. Maheshwara means great controller. Sarva Loka Maheshwara. Suridam Sarva Bhutanam. He's the well-wisher of all living entities. And if you really understand that, you'll understand Krishna and Yatvamam Shanti Richati. You'll become peaceful. You have a peaceful mind. Otherwise, if you keep fighting, trying to be the center, you're always going to be disturbed. And that's a description given of Ravana, Aranyakashipu, all these personalities, as well as any of us who tries to be the center. Our mind is always disturbed. And if you're not peaceful, you can't be happy. Anyway, so this is the introduction to the ninth chapter. So we didn't get a chance to read any of it, sorry. But I don't want to go on too long. So anyone have any questions about anything we said or comments? Yes, Ricardo.
I had a question. You were talking somewhat about the mind.
Yeah.
A little bit. Sometimes it seems like when we're trying to do more positive things in life, our mind can just kind of really get at us heavy.
Yeah.
And like it's hard to sleep. How do you deal with that?
That's an interesting question. We understand there's the mind, and then there's the intelligence. Intelligence is something different from the mind by which you can look down at the mind. Let me try to explain it thoroughly. It's like you have to develop the capacity to be able to look at the mind in as a separate entity, basically, and say, my mind is doing this now. My mind is doing that now. But I want this, or my goal in life is this. That's the intelligence. That's the buddhi. Therefore, Krishna talks about buddhi yoga. So you develop a goal in life, and based on that goal, you could neglect the mind or control the mind or focus the mind depending upon your situation. Let's say materially your intelligence, your goal, let's say material intelligence, your goal is to make a lot of money and you're a businessman. And so you know to make a lot of money, you've got to wake up early in the morning to go to the stock market. But your mind is saying, I want to sleep. Typical example, right? I mean, when the alarm clock rings in the morning, some of you who go to work know what I'm talking about. It rings. Of course, we have people who now have a sunshine alarm clock. Instead of ringing, it gradually gets brighter and brighter and brighter. Right? And so, they get up early in the morning. So that's one way to conquer the mind. So, but the mind, you know, generally when the alarm goes off in the morning, you haven't got enough sleep the night before, your mind is saying no. But your intelligence knows, I gotta go to work, or I gotta make this money. So you have some goal. Intelligence is in the mode of passion. Because you have a goal. You understand? There's a goal. So spiritual intelligence is in the mode of transcendental goodness, but we're talking about material intelligence at this particular juncture. So if you have a goal, you can pretty much ignore. Just like the horse who is in the horse race, sometimes the horse is used to wear blinders. You know what a blinder is? Yeah, they always see straight, because if they look to the side, they see the other horse or the jockey making faces at them. Or whatever, you know, I'm not into racing. Nor did I bet at horse races. But I've seen pictures like that. So the horse has to be really focused. A.K.H. Krishna talks about this, of course. Yavasayatmaka buddhir A.K.H. Kurnandana. So to be successful in spirituality, or even in the material world, you have to be focused on the goal. Because otherwise the mind will drag you accepting and rejecting things from moment to moment. Things just like disturb you. Like if I was to start to think about my mind right now, it's really hot in here. So if I would start to think about my mind, I think it's too hot. I can't go on speaking about this. I just want to go outside and get a little fresh air. But I ignore that. See, the mind is telling me that. Go outside, get some fresh air. Open the window, please. So. It's cold. Anyway, forget about my mind. No, that's all right. She won't be able to get it open. Oh, really? Thank you. Thank you. In other words, I'm ignoring what my mind until I started to concentrate on it. Thank you. So I was ignoring my mind to accomplish what I wanted to do, which is to speak to you about Krishna. Also, you know, if I started to think about my mind right now, I'd start to think, oh, I'm actually hungry. This is dinner time for me. What am I doing sitting here? You know, there's all sorts of things I can get into with my mind if I choose, because I know. You understand the example I'm giving?
Yeah.
Right now, there's all sorts of things I can get into if I just go to the mental platform. I'm hungry. Hasta luego. You know, auf Wiedersehen. You know. Ciao. But I choose not to. Because I know that I'm servant of Srila Prabhupada, so this is my duty to sit here and explain Bhagavad Gita to you, and I'm happy to do it. The soul's happy. The mind may not be happy. You understand the difference? The mind may be saying, what the hell are you doing, you know? What about me? And so the soul is saying, thank you for following me. So that's how do you control the mind? You understand? Distinguish. But it requires, how do you, distinguish you have to require study. Study the Vedic literature. The Vedic literatures teach us how to be goal-oriented, what to do, what not to do. There's a negative again. And in this way, we can proceed towards the spiritual goal. But it takes a lot of strength. Control. The mind is Chanchala Himana Krishna Pramati Balabhadridam Tashaham Nigraham Manye Vayori Bashirushkaram. The mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong. To control it is more difficult than controlling the wind, Arjuna says in the sixth chapter of the Gita. But Krishna says, by constant practice and detachment, one can do it. It takes practice to control the mind. It takes years and years and years of practice. And still, you know, sometimes the mind just comes up and rears its head. But anyway, you understand the example?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any other questions or comments? Yes.
Is there a relation between mind and consciousness?
Yes. Consciousness, of course, comes from the soul. And the soul, consciousness basically means awareness. So the soul is aware of what's happening in the mind, and the soul is also aware of what's happening in the intelligence if the soul is not in the mode of ignorance or passion. There's a little bit of difference. See, that's why we emphasize coming to the mode of goodness. In the mode of goodness, one can distinguish between these different impulses or thoughts or plans that are coming. Because we're being bombarded right now by a lot of different stimuli. That's the consciousness. We're from the body. You know, if I think of what's happening in my body, of course I can't tell really what's happening all over the body, but I can just focus my attention right now to the body and feel my feet if I want to, or I can... Let's see, what else can I feel? My stomach is hungry. I mentioned that already. And you know, I feel I'm hot. You know, so I can focus my attention. Or I can focus my attention on my mind. Or I can focus my attention on my goals of life. You know, I want to be Christian. So I have that choice. So the soul has the ability to focus or refocus attention according to its desire. We have that, all of us have that ability. Of course, in order to execute that ability, one has to cultivate the mode of goodness, which means food in the mode of goodness, lifestyle in the mode of goodness, music in the mode of goodness. I mean, if you're listening all the time to rap music, you may not be able to cultivate that ability. You know, because that, you know, music in the mode, there's music in the mode of ignorance and passion, there's food in the mode of ignorance and passion. Food in the mode of ignorance is food, according to Krishna, is tasteless, stale, decomposed, putrid. Not only meat, but, you know, like Limburger cheese or something like that. Food in the mode of passion would be, you know, a hot pepper sabji. Or a sabji with just mustard. You know, just take some yellow mustard and squirt it in your mouth. You know, that's definitely in the mode of passion. So if you're in those modes, you lose the ability to focus your attention on the intelligence, to refocus your intelligence, your attention. But when one is cultivating the mode of goodness, one has that ability to focus. You understand, control the mind. Basically, we're talking control the mind, control of consciousness. So we can control, we can focus our, just to reiterate, we can focus our attention on the body, I can focus it on the mind, or I can focus it on my goal of life, or I can focus it on Krishna. That comes from the mode of goodness. Very important. You know, there's a time of day that's in the mode of goodness, like midnight, it's definitely not in the mode of goodness. Early morning, Brahma Muhurta. That's why Prabhupada, all spiritualists, not just Prabhupada, but all spiritualists stress early morning time. I mean, I've been in monasteries before, not as a monk, don't worry, visiting, and they all wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You know, because that's the time. I mean, any monastery you go to, isn't it? They recognize. So that's a universal across all cultures and religions, that basically the early morning. And when I'm in Bosnia, I live right next to a mosque. And guess what happens at 4:30 in the morning? there's a call to prayer. I mean, I don't go there, but I respect that. At 4:30 in the morning, yeah, Mangalarti time. Okay, it's Mangalarti. Mangalarti, Allah. Not exactly, but so there's an understanding in various cultures that that's a time for spirituality. It's interesting, isn't it? Interesting how that's cross-cultural, that particular understanding. So that the point I'm making is the mode of goodness is essential to cultivate, to be able to control your consciousness and focus it on your goals in life, especially the spiritual goals. So that's what I'm advocating. I think we have to end now. Right? Yeah, I don't want to go on too long. So there's prasadam. I hope. One more question. Yeah. I don't want to get too controversial here. take the potato chips away from them. Things that are too salty, too hot, that's generally passion.
Too stimulating.
Too stimulating, yeah. Like, you know, people often ask, and thank you for that question, because people often ask us, why not onions and garlic? What's wrong with onions and garlic? Well, garlic's an easy one, because if you eat garlic, I won't want to be in the same room with you. I mean, that's an easy one, because in fact, I fly a lot, not without a plane, but, you know, with a plane. And if I have to sit next to someone with garlic, I'd rather sit next to a baby that's doing its thing in its diapers rather than sit next to someone who's eating garlic. It's so obnoxious, the smell. And then as far as onions, I mean, when you cut them, I remember when I was young, my mother would cut onions. What do? You cry. And they stimulate you too much in the mode of passion. So we're trying to, the whole point of spiritual life is to be able to focus your mind or focus your consciousness. Let's even use a more general term. Focus your consciousness where you want to focus your consciousness. That's yoga. Actually, according to Patanjali, the whole point is to stop the turning of the mind. He uses the word vritti, which in English later on becomes vert, like invert, subvert, pervert, revert. And so that's the whole purpose of yoga, you know, the hatha yoga system, is to stop so you can focus it on Krishna. I mean, obviously, if you stop the turning of the mind, you have to do something with it. The mind can't be inactive by nature. You have to focus it on something positive. So that's what we're advocating, cultivating the mode of goodness. So you're eating, you're sleeping, you're mating, you're defending, your sporting activities, whatever you do, cultivate the mode of goodness, and then you can focus your mind, and then you'll have great power to do things. Great power to do things. I mean, look at the example of Srila Prabhupada. I'll end with that. Srila Prabhupada coming over from India had two heart attacks on the boat. Now, some of you might have had heart attacks in this room. I'm not going to ask who had heart attacks. But I know people with heart attacks. They go through an extensive period of recuperation afterwards. They don't just like get off the boat and start preaching, do they? Do they? I mean, I'm asking. I mean, I know people. I mean, I had a lot of friends who've had heart attacks. I've had a lot of relatives who've had heart attacks or strokes. Prabhupada also had a stroke too. Yet he gets off the boat and goes immediately, and don't tell me his body wasn't like suffering. It was. I mean, the body, you know, the physical body has certain things that happen to it. So he gets off the boat and immediately goes to Butner, Pennsylvania and starts preaching. Like nothing happened. That's control of the mind. Can you imagine? I mean, if I had even a mini heart attack, I'd be asking everyone to serve me. I'd be in bed sipping mint juleps or whatever. You know, just on my swing all the time and chanting Hare Krishna, asking someone to read to me.
you know, fanning me, you know, having all these people feeding me grapes or whatever. I'm just joking about that. But, you know, I wouldn't be able to do that. But control the mind like that, like Prabhupada exhibited, think about it for a second. I mean, we can say, you know, yes, Prabhupada was transcendental. However, the body was undergoing what anybody's body undergoes when you've had a heart attack. Try to understand that. And that is someone who can control the mind and the senses. That is a real yogi. Yoginama pi sarvesham madgatena antaratmana shadavam bhajate yomam same yuktatama mataha. So anyway, so that I'll leave you with that example of Srila Prabhupada, who was perfectly able to control the mind after undergoing so much difficulty. Physically. You know, and he was old. Prabhupada was born in 1896, and he came to America in 65. He was 70 years old. And he didn't have any credit cards, mobile phones, what else? iPads, money. You know, my mind would be saying, go back. Stay in Vrindavan, you know. But Prabhupada was controlling it with his... Why? Because his goal-oriented, serve my spiritual master, please my spiritual master. That was his goal. And therefore, he was specifically empowered because of that one-pointed determination. And that order to preach in the Western world was given to other disciples of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. But Prabhupada had that one point. So Prabhupada controlled the mind more than anyone else. That was the point I'm making. He controlled and gave everything to Krishna. That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's easy for you to say, well, he was just transcendental, but the body was still suffering. And Prabhupada did it. And that's a real hero. Talk about what a hero is. Someone who can control the mind, ignore what's happening in the body, and carry out the mission of Sri Krishna. Okay, on that happy note, we'll take prasadam. Hopefully they turned up the heat upstairs. I hope they did. Hope Mama did that. All glories to His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada.